Hello and welcome to the Let's Talk Bipolar podcast, hosted by Emma Bell and brought to you by Bipolar UK. You can find all of our resources at www.bipolaruk.org. This week I am buzzing to say that my lovely friend Chris is on the show. Now, Chris, I met nearly a decade ago now.
Yeah.
And she really has been a huge influence and impact on me talking very openly about my mental health illness, my suicidal periods in life, because they invited me to talk at what we'll go on to talk about a lot of the work that Chris does and did and still does. But she invited me to talk and share my story of when I attempted suicide for myself. And it was really kind of the first time that I'd done something like that, but it kind of empowered me and gave me courage to keep using my voice and to keep talking about things. So I owe a lot of what I do to you. And I am just so excited to have you here today, Chris. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Emma. I'm thrilled to be here. And I want to say just how proud I am of you and all the ways that you've been open and honest and direct about suicide and its prevention and mental health. I know that will have a huge impact on people, and I'm thrilled to be here.
Oh, thank you. Well, a lot of what I have learnt about not being afraid to talk about suicide and not being afraid to be direct about talking about suicide has really literally come from this lady, because the way that she teaches and taught me and has taught hundreds and hundreds and hundreds upon hundreds of people over your career in this field. So can we introduce you? Can you tell our audience a little bit about you, how long you've been in this arena, which I know is a very long time? Tell us a little bit about how you're in this space.
Oh, with pleasure. Well, I guess I'm one of the founders of a suicide prevention charity called Grassroots Suicide Prevention that Emma volunteered for at the time I was working there. And Grassroots teaches and came into existence to teach a program called Applied Suicide Intervention Skills Training, which is a two-day practical course that teaches a model of how to help someone who's thinking about suicide make a choice not to kill themselves. It's evidence-based, it's research-based, it's owned by a Canadian company called Living Works, and Grassroots taught and still teaches Assist in Brighton and Hove and the surrounding areas. And at the time I was involved, also taught a program called Safe Talk, Suicide Alertness for Everyone, and programs around mental health and so on and so forth. And Emma and some friends and family of hers came to support the charity and fundraise and do all that they could to amplify our work. And we had a relationship, Emma, where I connected with you with a mental health wellness recovery action plan. Mm-hmm. I still remember that to this day. That's mm-hmm. working with you on that has had quite a big impact on me as well, actually.
Really?
yeah, it has. I still teach people about something called a wellness recovery action plan, which is a plan that anyone can make at a time when we're feeling okay, in anticipation that there might become a time when we're not okay. And that could be around mental health or emotional overwhelm or stress levels or a physical health condition. Mm-hmm. We looked at one around your mental health at mm-hmm. the time. And a wrap helps us to clock early warning signs that maybe things aren't going so well for us, and then mm-hmm. how we can plan to deal with those and how we can deal with triggers that come up. Mm. The thing that I found really, that I learned a lot from working with you, is that it was the first time I've worked with somebody who had bipolar disorder mm-hmm. working on a wrap. So the early warning signs for you were partly about signs that you were becoming depressed, and on the other hand, signs that you might be becoming high. Uh-huh. So we had two completely different sets of plans, of triggers, of responses, and it was mm-hmm. so helpful. And I've been able to share that with lots of other people.
Oh, I'm really glad. Yeah, I mean, that is for sure. I mean, the warning signs of hypomania go unnoticed. Yes. For so many people, and it's a big factor of why people don't get diagnosed on average. I think it's 9 years.
It is, yeah.
And it's because of these things, because we tend to only, unless you go, you know, into mania, and then at which point everyone really turns around and says, this person's not right, not well, there's something serious going on here. But when you're smashing it and not needing any sleep, unfortunately, it plays into culture and society's ideal of acing life. And and it's not for someone with bipolar. It's the warning signs of we're on the brink of really being very unwell. So yeah, you're right. The things that would go into a safety plan or a RAP plan, they're very different for the two dynamics of bipolar. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. And I've never named you, but that learning has helped a lot of other people. So thank you.
Ah, that's good to hear. If I can help another bipolar bear, I'm happy about that.
I reckon you have indirectly, for sure. So I still teach suicide prevention content. At the moment, because of the pandemic, Living Works isn't rolling out a system safe talking classroom. So instead, lots of providers have turned to webinars. So I teach some of my own suicide prevention content. I've also been, over the last 5 years, working in LGBTQ inclusion, particularly in healthcare settings, but more broadly. I've trained as an embodied facilitator. So I've been learning about ways that we as facilitators can bring our bodies into the work that we do. And the more I teach webinars, the more I try to encourage participants to be embodied. We learn better, I think, when we're able to be present in our bodies. And engage with each other. I teach stuff around well-being and resilience with an angle on mental health and suicide prevention and the body. I teach a lot of stuff around LGBTQ awareness and inclusion, and I also teach content around equality, diversity and inclusion. So the older I've got, the more passionate I've got about helping communities and community members to have the skills that we need to take care of each other, to have honest, direct conversations that help to diminish shame and taboo and stigma. And that, I think, is kind of key to why I think I might be on the planet. Something like that.
You were definitely sent here with a purpose, and you're definitely fulfilling it, because I would love to get a list of every single person you've helped, because it would be immense numbers, absolutely immense numbers. I'm certain of it.
It's a funny one, Emma, because I think I realised a long time ago that I didn't want to have children. And in a way, I'm not really attached to the idea of legacy at all. I don't mind too much what happens after I'm dead, which, you know, inevitably all of us will be. But I think about grassroots and that I was really involved in conceiving and developing the Stay Alive app, which is a suicide prevention app, and it's had over 10,000 downloads, and I know it's helping people.
It's that is definitely and has definitely saved people's lives.
It's amazing, isn't it? And it's a team effort. It was a whole team effort with the grassroots team, the digital company, everyone that said their ideas in a survey. But I love that Grassroots now has funding from the Department of Health and is running with it. It's going from strength to strength, and I'm so proud of that.
Amazing, amazing. And that's a different story. I remember one of the World Suicide Prevention Day that we did, we were printing off the logo and safety pinning it on the front of t-shirts.
I remember that.
But it's just amazing though, isn't it? What a seed will grow into. It's just incredible, and then the lengths and breadths that it stretches to in terms of helping people is just amazing.
And I think I there's, in terms of suicide, attempted and completed suicide, there is such inequalities in which sectors of our communities are attempting suicide and dying by suicide more often, and poverty is a factor, and stigma and shame and mental illness and LGBTQ identities and discrimination and bullying and harassment, and all of these things filter into some of the reasons that some people choose to attempt suicide. And I'm just keen to address that balance wherever possible, and thanks for the opportunity to say a little about that here.
I would love to talk to you and help. I'd love someone to go away from this with something they can use.
Yes.
I would love someone to come away from this not feeling as fearful about talking to somebody directly about suicide. A lot of people comment, I share things and I will talk quite directly and openly about suicide, and I'm not afraid to talk about it. Part of that is down to my own experience. Part of that is down to you and meeting you and having your training. How can we help people to lose the fear about talking? Because people want to help, they just don't know what to
Yes.
say. They're
Yes.
terrified that if they say the wrong thing, that that might make someone be go and act on their suicidal thoughts. They think, we won't say anything, won't mention it, and that way they won't do it. Because if I
Yes.
mention it, I might push them to do it. So can we debunk some of the myths and the fear talk around this in this conversation?
Yes, that's a brilliant invitation. Thank you. Wow. As we know, in terms of the myths, I think one of the biggest myths out there is that if we talk to someone openly about suicide, that we're going to put the idea in their heads and make them more vulnerable to attempting suicide. And it simply isn't true. It's a huge myth. Lots of research has shown that asking people if they're thinking about killing themselves is the safest thing we can do if someone's struggling with thoughts of suicide. Whereas to not ask them about their thoughts doesn't actually contribute towards their safety. So if someone is thinking about suicide and we ask them directly and clearly about that, and I'll come onto that in a moment, then we give them permission to talk about a subject that's stigmatized and seen as shameful. And we say, I might be frightened, but I'm asking because I care about you and I care whether you live or die. I care whether you're suffering or in distress or in pain. So help me understand, how bad are things for you? Are you thinking about killing yourself or are you thinking about suicide? And if we, I'm often nervous or scared when I ask that question, especially if I love someone. I don't want that person to die, but asking and knowing the truth and then being able to say, well, I'm here and I care and I want to understand. Tell me more. That's really important and precious, and we can deal with our fear later, or we can deal with it in the moment, but we need to get round that fear to ask.
And do you also feel, because I do, that by asking that question, it's also a very direct and accurate way to quickly work out if that's really not in their thoughts as well?
Brilliant. Because if someone's not thinking about suicide, they'll almost always say something like, oh, no, I'm not thinking about killing myself. Things are bad, but they're not that bad.
Correct.
So, and if they say no, we don't stop being their friend or offering support or caring. But if they say yes, then they know that we're the kind of person who cares and wants to know about suicide.
But I think it just helps everybody's expectations, because since I have, in the last 10 years, I have gone through periods of being suicidal and having suicidal thoughts. And now people around me are more confident to ask me that question.
Yes.
And when they do, I can quickly say, no, that's not where I'm at. I'm just having a
Yes.
really bad day, week. I need to do X, Y, Z, now that I'm more versed in it. But if I am in that moment, it gives me permission to stop pretending and to stop putting on a face for everyone and go, yeah, like that has gone through my head. That is how bad this is. That is where I'm at. And
Yes.
it's also a realization for me to say, actually, yeah, maybe I need to step up my support. Maybe I need that extra help right now. And it's sort of a
Yes.
self-realization for me as the receiving person too.
It's interesting, isn't it? And I think you're right, it is a reality check for you and the person who's asked you the question. And I think it's so important that we ask a clear and direct question. I would say something like, are you thinking about suicide? Or are you thinking about killing yourself? And if we use other language, like, you're not thinking about doing something stupid, are you? Or you're not thinking about suicide, are you? Or are you thinking about ending it all? When we use euphemistic terms like that, we can be given the message that we don't really want to know, or that we're scared, we're too scared to want to know the answer. So we look to be calm and centered as best we can. But before we ask about suicide, there's always a reason why we ask. We don't ask out of the blue. So my first piece of advice would be to invite your listeners to be alert to potential warning signs that someone might be struggling to be on the planet, to be alive. And we might see things like changes in people's mood or their behaviours. Some people might drink more or use drugs. Others people might not do those things, but people can have disturbances in their sleep or their appetite or their libido. People can become tearful, can talk about death or dying. We might hear people saying things like, I'd be better off dead, or people would be better off without me. Sometimes people do what we call final acts. So in anticipation of their death, they might write a will or ask you to sign a will or witness it. They might put their affairs in order or give away possessions or say goodbye to people. They might cry a lot. And I guess the invitation to anyone who wants to support someone who could be thinking about suicide would be to explore these things. Let them know what you've noticed. I've noticed you're crying a lot and you haven't been to work for days, and that when you do come in, you can't concentrate, and I'm worried about you.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we hear enough to be concerned, and we should really check this out, if we are seeing these things that we could call invitations to ask if someone's thinking about suicide, then we can say something like, you know, sometimes when people are really tearful and they're talking about people around them being better off without them, they might be thinking about suicide. And I wonder, are you thinking about suicide?
Chris always just has a wonderful way of speaking. It's gentle and firm and loving and non-judgmental, and it's everything that's required to call somebody in and make them feel safe enough, like their big difficult feelings and emotions can be held enough to speak their truth. Right,
that's right. And then yeah, exactly. So we, by the way we ask and the way we reflect and listen, creates the conditions where we are asking clearly and sincerely, as if we really want to know the answer. And then if someone says no, as we know, that's okay. If they say yes, I would suggest the next thing that we can say is, I'm listening, and create space for that person to talk. Or we might say, help me understand why you want to die. Help me understand how your life has come to this point. Or help me understand why now, why are you thinking about suicide right now? And if we hold space, gradually we help someone to feel understood. Doesn't have to be for a long time. 10 minutes or so can be enough. And as we hear someone talk about their reasons for death and for dying, sometimes we can hear little signs of life or hope or connections to life, reasons to live. So we might be able to reflect that back to someone, something like, while it sounds like for you everything feels like it's heading towards suicide and you can't see another way out to deal with these problems, at the same time, you've just said something like, but I don't know who would look after my cat if I died. And I wonder if you might be uncertain about suicide, and perhaps if there's a part of you that's not ready to go yet, if there's something keeping you here, do you think we could work together on a plan to help you keep safe for now? So we're not asking someone to stay alive forever or to commit to their decision about death. We're saying, how about trying to stay safe for now so we can put some support in place for you? And then we move on to the final part, which is about connecting people to supports or resources that can help them to stay alive. So crisis services of some kind, helplines. Maybe they need access to services like counselling support or medication or a faith community. We can help to put some of those things in place. And that those are the steps I would suggest to anyone listening.
And I think that's really important. The last step is really important with helping people feel more confident about stepping into conversations like this, using the language that you suggested, because I'm just guessing that some people might feel, well, once I start it, what do I do when they say, yes, I am? And also a feeling of responsibility of, well, then I'm going to be have to be the one to fix this, and feeling completely out of their depth. And but the key message in this that I'm hearing from you, which you have, you know, you've taught me, I know from you, is it's not your job to fix them. And it, you know, you're not the professional person. It's just about a stepping stone to the next step.
Absolutely.
And I think that when people hear this and they can understand their little cog in the whole overall picture, that they don't have to suddenly be the one to carry all of this weight. And it is a scary weight. You know, that's what support services are here for. We haven't been trained to do these things, right? It can feel overwhelming to dip into that pond, because how deep am I going to go, and then am I going to be able to bring that person back out again?
Yes.
And I think it creates fear for people.
That you're absolutely right, and I think the fear can stop us from asking in the first place, because we don't want to be responsible for someone else's life. And to that I would say, we are not responsible for someone else's life or choice or actions. We are not saving someone's life. And that language is really prevalent, and it's a bit of a shame, I think, because it muddies the waters. We're not saving someone's life. We are putting someone in touch with a service or a crisis line or an agency that can help that person to save their own life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it really does. And autonomy comes into this too, for the person that is experiencing suicidal thoughts or making suicidal plans, that has suicidal intent.
Yes.
When autonomy is taken away from them, it can actually be very disempowering. In ways. And quite often, I know just from my own experience of feeling suicidal, you can feel very out of control, and you feel like you're failing at everything, and you feel like you're no good at anything, and you feel like you can't do anything.
Yes.
So actually, to have this kind of stabilizing conversation that helps you to see that, for example, one of the questions that came up in the training when I did it with you was, how long do you feel you can keep yourself safe for?
That's right.
Now, that's not disempowering at all, because what it does is it helps both people. Me, say I'm the person that's experiencing suicidal thoughts and making plans, I can sit there and say, 2 hours.
Yes.
It gives everyone a really good benchmark of where we're at.
Yes.
You know, and then what do you think you can do to keep yourself safe in those 2 hours? So it's not that someone's going to have to come in and rescue me. It's asking them, how long can you keep yourself? How long do you feel you can keep yourself safe for? Right. And then what do you think you can do to keep yourself safe? And then what can we do? And what can I help you to connect you with, to then bring you to more safety?
It's fantastic. I'm so glad you've remembered it that way. You're so right, Emma. You're so right.
Well, I had a very good teacher.
I think my favourite question when it comes to starting a safety plan is, I think traditionally in healthcare culture, there's very much a model of risk assessment and mitigation being done to people. Mm. So tell me your risks, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. I will construct a safety plan in this way, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. But if we can start with a question like, right now, what will help you keep safe?
Mm-hmm.
Then we can, ideally it's about collaboration, we can sit back and prepare to be surprised. And I remember working with someone who was thinking about suicide, and I asked her, right now, what would help you keep safe? Instead of chipping in with my own panicky ideas, because I wanted her safe. And she said, well, I've been thinking about using my cat's medicine, and I've looked it up, and I know if I use a certain amount, it would be fatal in overdose. So I need to stop that happening. And she decided to lock away the bulk of the medication at the other end of the house with a lock and a key. And every day she just took out what the cat needed and put it in the cat's, you know, bowl at the right time. And she wrote a big poster and stuck it on the medication box saying, don't you dare use my medication to kill yourself. I need the meds from the cat. I need the meds to be all right. And she
I love
stayed, you know,
that.
that was her plan and
Yeah.
it was hers and it worked for her.
For sure. And it is. So I live in Dubai in a high-rise tower.
Amazing.
And last year I went through a period of being very low to the point that I was having suicidal like flashes of images of what I thought I might act on.
Yes.
And I kept having this recurring image of me just going over the balcony.
Yeah.
And I came back to the training I received from you,
Huh.
which was, okay, what can I do? How, you know, when I suddenly feel impulsive and this overwhelming pull, what can
Yes.
I do? Well, I can go in, I can lock the patio doors, and I can go into the one room in the house that doesn't have a door to the balcony, and I can shut the door, and I can open up the laptop, and I can put Netflix on, and I can stay there and just hold on tight till the feeling passes. And then I can tell my husband, you know, as soon as I see him, just so you know. And I do that. If I even have a flash now for a second, I don't
Yeah.
feel shame about it. I just say, do you know what? Just today I had some mad flash just run through my head, 3 seconds, phew, gone. But it came and it went. But I don't
Yes.
keep it inside and I tell him.
Yes.
He through obviously he was exposed to your suicide prevention
Yeah.
day and you know, and he was like, thank you for telling me. Is there anything that I can do to help you? What do you need? And I'll say, well, I've done this and this is what I'm going to do. And he's like, okay. And is there anything that we can do or you need? Do you want to go for a walk? Should we go and see the psychiatrist? You know, and it's collaborative, like you say, and it's so empowering. And these are skills that I learned and I continue to take them with me, right?
Yes.
And no one comes in and takes over my life. And that's key to staying well, I think.
Thank you for sharing that, Emma. And I'm so sad things got to that point, and they sometimes do, don't they? And I'm really moved by the way you looked after yourself and that Gareth is part of that net, that support for you. He sounds like a keeper.
It's
Post.
amazing, amazing living with someone that lives with bipolar, you know, he's an amazing support. But it's just accepting that for me, certainly these things can come and go, but what do we do? What are my tools?
Yeah.
What are my go-tos? What are the questions I need to ask myself? You know, what's my crisis plan that I've signed myself? You know, again, Chris taught
Yes.
me this. I write the plan when I'm well, and at the bottom, I sign it. And guess what? If things go
Yeah.
off the charts, out of hand, Gareth can say, Emma, you see this? And I'll go, oh yeah, I
Oh,
did that.
yeah.
I did that. And my signature, okay. That's
It's
the
brilliant. It's so simple. And for me,
plan.
there's something so ordinary about thinking about suicide. Like it, we know this is part of the human condition. As long as humans have existed, so have thoughts of suicide. And we live in a culture where suicide is seen as a sin in some major world religions. It's been seen as a crime in Western Europe and North America and many other places worldwide. So we carry a lot of shame and stigma, but it needs to be as normal as saying to someone, how are you feeling today, or how's your depression? Is it would be to check in. Are you still thinking about suicide? How's that going for you? How can I help? And I really want to mention a few resources that your listeners can access. So one is that wherever you are in the world, you can look up befrienders.org to find out crisis services near you. And if you'd like to know more about the steps for helping someone to keep safe, or ways that you as a caregiver or helper can have support too, I would recommend downloading the Stay Alive app, and you can download it and read about it on Grassroots Suicide Prevention's website, which is prevent-suicide.org.uk. And from that website, I think under resources, you can also download your own wrap, your own safety plan to
If you've
complete.
got
And I think there's
bipolar, you
one.
need two people. Just please know that. If you've got bipolar, one won't cut it. You need
So good.
to.
Thanks, Emma.
I also know that you are an associate trainer with Papyrus as well, which is particularly with young people, right?
That's right, yes. I think it no one's been teaching assist since the start of the pandemic, so things have been quiet on that front, which is why I've taken time to draw my learning into my own kind of three-hour package, webinar package. Also, a colleague and friend of mine called Rose Allitt has joined with a charity called Ollie's Future in Worthing, and they are teaching a 90-minute talking about suicide program, which teaches 10 tools or 10 steps to prevent suicide that anyone can take and learn.
Amazing.
Those skills. So I'm looking, always looking for ways to kind of get the teaching out there, because to me, again, it's just part of being human. If we have compassion, if we care about each other, then I think it really is important to be able to just have these honest conversations.
Mm-hmm.
I think culturally we can be so dissociated from pain and distress and want to keep it at arm's length.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all struggling. Everyone's having a hard time right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to be checking in with our friends, our family, our colleagues. And also for us, by us, I just mean myself, really, and anyone who's listening and anyone who's working in services or teaching these skills, we are not immune just because we talk about this work. So there's a level of self-awareness and self-honesty as well that matters.
For sure. And taking care of yourself, it's that taking care of yourself before you take care of others. And I think that's also like a society thing. So for me, I grew up in a home where I watched my mother be selfless.
Yes.
And I think this
yes.
is a very common theme with mothers, that mothers
yes.
should be selfless. And
yes.
it's all very nice what I'm now learning, and don't get me wrong, I just adore her. She's the most adorable
yes.
human being in the entire world. I love her
yes.
with my every bone. But looking back, I now have learned a few more things, and I've learned about boundaries, and I can see she deserved to do more for herself.
Yeah.
And
yes,
she deserved to do more for herself, and it wouldn't have made her less of a mother. It wouldn't
yeah.
have made her less of a human. And what it would have done, though, is shown me and that when I got older, I could look after
yes.
myself before I gave to others. But instead, the message was, when you or what's modeled, what
yes.
you speak and what you model, kids are watching what you model, right?
Yeah, right.
For sure.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
when they get older, they will probably replicate what they were modeled, not what they were told to do. So I look there as a young person, mum's doing everything for everyone at the cost of herself, at the cost of her own, you know, food, sleep, you know, whatever.
Yes,
she
yes.
comes at the bottom of the pile.
Mm.
On a subconscious level, you learn, oh, okay, well, when I get to that level, then that's
yes.
what I should be doing. So then
yes.
there's this like guilt factor of, well, if I put myself first, I'm selfish. Because
yes.
that's not what you do to be a good human, right? So
yeah.
it's untangling that and realizing that actually we are better servers when we've
yes.
served ourselves first.
And that's radical, right?
It's
radical.
It's a radical thought. It's a radical thing to unlearn. It's like mind blown.
I'm fascinated by this because I think I grew up with a similar model from my mum. Mm. And I also think that those of us who are drawn to helping professions or to service in any way often have a tendency to do that at the expense of our own needs, or to see that as selfish.
Mm.
And I teach some content around well-being and resilience, and I started looking up the origins of self-care. I've got really curious about where this self-care movement comes from, and it's far more, far greater than pampering, baths, crystals, sound baths, massage. The deeper roots of radical self-care, I've learned about the beginnings of the movements, the Black Civil Rights Movement in the States, and how Black women first started to take care of their bodies in response to the way the healthcare systems were racist and sexist. And in fact, by the time the Black Panther movement was underway, you weren't able to start a new Black Panther chapter in any geographical area unless you first built a Black-owned and Black-run healthcare clinic. because the value of self-care for activists and people fighting oppression was recognised as so important.
Wow.
It's amazing stuff. And also, I'm a huge fan of someone on Instagram called Hannah Daisy. I think her handle is at Make Daisy Chains, and she talks about boring self-care. I love this stuff. So if you live with a disability, as I do, or a mental health condition, as I do, sometimes self-care like massages or pampering is out of reach, and instead self-care becomes about the small victories that you do every day because you have to, that help you to get through the day. So putting your daytime clothes on in the daytime, or cooking a nourishing meal, or going to pick up your prescription, cleaning the toilet. And she draws these medals that you can give yourself for boring self-care. But I love it. It's great to have these different frames on things we do to look after ourselves.
For sure. And I'm totally on board with that, especially around just my own experience of the lower phases of bipolar. A self-care list on a low phase of bipolar looks like having a shower.
Yes.
Washing your hair would still be a huge achievement, but washing your body in the shower would be a huge win. Putting on clean clothes and finding the strength to feed yourself.
That's good stuff.
Is absolutely acing a low day when living with bipolar, for example.
Absolutely. That's four medals right there.
Yes, I want all the medals. But it's true, because, and there was a great post actually that I saw, and it was like how to get through yourself through a low day, the real one. And it was like, it was really good. It was about five or six slides. I must find it actually. And it was like, get the Batiste, chuck it in your hair. Haven't got the energy for a shower? Use a baby wipe. Yes. Change your knickers. That's important. And it was just stuff like that.
Love
and I was like, yes, this is written by someone who really gets what it's like to be so low in the trenches that even having a shower is too much. So they're saying, just make sure you've got a pack of baby wipes somewhere in your house and wipe it over the bits that smell a bit more and put on some clean knickers. And
that's
like, yes, you get it.
Because, and it is like that. Yeah, it's overwhelming. It sometimes anything more than that is overwhelming.
For sure.
And it's been a really humbling year for me, because like everyone, I've been through it in terms of this pandemic. It's been a roller coaster rise, and like some real joys and strengths found. And also, I remember teaching wellbeing and resilience webinars when maybe half an hour beforehand I'd been on the floor having a bit of a cry because I couldn't face doing anything. And that's human. That's it not is. Failing. That's just being human. And I think if we are living in service or working in service, self-care of whatever kind is crucial. And also it's easy to get into a self-blaming space as well. I should be better at self-care.
This should business. So
suck it.
There's a girl that I'm a good like a chat with, and she says to me every time I start shoulding on myself, my husband says, "You're doing that thing again. You're shoulding all over yourself."
I love it. Yourself,
it doesn't lead anywhere good. And it's like, you know, when we should on ourselves and should on others. Now, I've done both a lot. You know, I've done a lot of shoulding on other people, and people have done a lot of shoulding on me, and I've done a lot of shoulding on myself. And one thing I know is it never leads anywhere good.
It doesn't, does it? No. It sucks.
It does
and that's
suck.
Another thing to unlearn. But I like the shoulding.
Let's not should. Don't do any shoulding. And he said that's like one of his warning signs for her mental health or emotional health taking a bit of a decline, is when he hears her or witnesses things where he's aware that she is shoulding on herself.
Yes.
And like, you're in this space again, you know, like you're doing the shoulding thing, you're shoulding all over yourself right now, you know, come on, come back out.
So good. And having a supportive person makes all the difference. Yeah. It really does.
And sort of throws a bit of humour into the mix, you know, like, come on, I can see you're shoulding all over yourself right now.
And that so matters, doesn't it, when you're feeling rubbish.
Yeah.
And there is humour. There is, I think there always is a grain of humour. There's a comic strip called by someone called Hyperbole and a Half. And I think it's called maybe Depression Part One or Part Two, but this human gets to the depths of the pit and is struggling with daily life and just really can't see any point. And at some point they wound up lying on their kitchen floor crying. It's a brilliant cartoon. And then they see a shriveled up bit of sweet corn under the fridge, and for whatever reason it makes them laugh, and they talk about lying on the floor having fits of giggles, and just in that moment everything changes because they haven't laughed for such a long time. But there are those little turning points. Sometimes humor can be a real turning point, a connection to life,
for sure. And if I'm having where any human actually experiences rage and anger and all of these things, but it can very much be heightened when you also live with bipolar. Like there's the bipolar rage that people will talk about, and Gareth will say to me, "So we need to get those boxing gloves out again." And because he used to box, so we got some boxing gloves, and he's like, "Should we get the boxing gloves out? Is that what you need? Come on, come on."
Oh.
And I'm like, yes, come on then. And I 3 minutes in, you can't do anything but laugh, you know, especially when I'm there boxing someone who's 6'4", you know, with a bad shoulder, and he's like an absolute unit. I mean, I can't take myself seriously 3 minutes in, you know. So it's good to have these things that you can kind of break that, you know, break it up a bit somehow. And it has to be with someone you feel safe with, and, you know, all of those things, obviously. But it's good if you can have these things in your life as extra kind of coping mechanisms, circuit breakers, right?
Totally, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And some research shows when it comes to suicide anyway, that the feeling of total distress and overwhelm can only last so long. And as you say, that heightened state will pass because your system can't maintain it for too long, which is good to know.
Chris, thank you so much for today. I'm so grateful to have you on. It's been wonderful to talk to you, and you've filled my soul back up today. So yeah,
it's a total joy to see you, Emma. It's absolutely total joy, and I wish you well with the podcast and all that you're doing service and for joy.
And where can we find you? Where can our listeners find you?
I am on Instagram at Chris Brown Facilitates, and I have a Facebook page with the same name, and my website is chrisbrown.uk.com.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you from my heart to yours. I'm very grateful for your time and energy in this space.
It's my total pleasure, Emma. Go well.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Let's Talk Bipolar, the podcast brought to you by Bipolar UK. Please go to our website, www.bipolaruk.org, for all of our resources and all of the support that we can offer you.